Welcome to Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series of the same title. The talks will be done in a more informal style, so you may wish to consult the printed texts, which are made available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. I hope you enjoy the talks. Thank you. I feel rather guilty directing you to read Zoltán Kevich's book, Metaphor, rather than books of my personal favorites, George Lakoff and Mark Johnson. I've taught their Metaphors We Live By a good many times. I have included metaphor as one of our topics because I think it is important that we understand how intertwined our language and metaphor. We must shift our attention away from the folk understanding of metaphor as a poetic trope that perhaps muddies meaning or prettifies it rather than clarifies it. Yet, I also wanted the excuse to think more extensively about the structurality of metaphor, especially in the context of the various perspectives we have been considering, such as Baudrillard's Seduction, Bateson's Play, and Merleau-Ponty's Flesh and Depth. Gesture is good to think, and I want to reflect on hands, particularly in light of the importance of body in language and communication. While strung together, my thoughts today span several topics. Kevich's defines metaphor, or specifically conceptual metaphor, as understanding one conceptual domain in terms of another conceptual domain. He explains that metaphor is a process of mapping entailments from the more concrete to the more abstract, and that the process is unidirectional, that is, the mappings go only in one direction. In his example, a very common one indeed, love is a journey, he holds that journey is the more concrete concept and that its entailments are mapped onto the more abstract love. The travelers are mapped as the lovers. The vehicle is the love relationship itself. The distance covered is the progress made, and so on. The importance of showing these characteristics of metaphor is that we soon begin to appreciate that our lives and our language are shot through with metaphors. We can scarcely come up with a simple statement that isn't based on some key metaphor, and we cannot find any concept or experience that we would hope to talk or think about free of metaphor. Minimally, an appreciation of metaphor at even a general level is an awakening. We recognize that concepts are based extensively in embodied experience and that there is a major fluidity in the grasping and expression of concepts. The structurality of metaphor is what interests me most, and I don't find that the extant discussions of metaphor have the same sophistication as do discussions of seduction, flesh, and depth. Let me explore metaphor structurality. First, I am rather fond of the simple definition that metaphor is to understand something in terms of something else which it is not. The convention for stating a metaphor is to use capital letters and the word is. For example, in all capital letters, love is a journey. In Kevich's example, love is the target and journey is the source, which means that he understands that journey is concrete and love is abstract. When I read his list of entailments and mappings, I think that a revision to his presentation is necessary. The word love names an emotion or a feeling, and I believe that all the attributes of love that Kevich's names refer to something other than love. Rather, they refer to a relationship. And indeed, all of the features that he assigns to love have little, if anything, so far as I can discern, to do with any emotion. The lovers, the relationship, the events of the relationship, the progress made, continuing on to the goals of the relationship. So first of all, it seems to me that there is a hidden element in this structurality, and it is actually love itself. And perhaps the hidden love in this metaphor represents something rather larger in the structurality of metaphor, and that is feeling or emotion. We know that love or feelings or emotions drive a relationship, but we are distracted from this hidden yet most important element in the double structure of metaphor. The unidirectional principle of metaphor is worth thinking about in this respect. Love is a journey, yet a journey is not love. The target is abstract, that is love, not journey, while the source is concrete, that is journey, not love. I want to contest this, but first, were we to consider unidirectionality in terms of the metaphor relationship as a journey, it would be less clear, because the inverse, journey is a relationship, isn't actually all that implausible. We might think of a journey as a relationship of the traveler through space related to the road, to the landscape, to the map, to fellow travelers, and so on. I'm far from convinced that metaphorical mappings are simply unidirectional. I believe that they must be reversible to some extent, yet simply incomplete in the reversibility. This is an important development in the understanding of metaphor. In metaphor, an essential condition is one thing is another thing. The word is a marker of reversibility. Were it truly unidirectional, the conventional presentation would be one thing, with an arrow pointing towards that, then another thing, with the left pointing arrow to indicate the mapping of the source domain named second onto the target domain named first. Is means they are equal, yet different, and thus, in some respects, reversible. Mappings of entailments cannot occur without some oscillatory negotiative reversal. However, another essential condition of metaphor is that the one thing is also not the other thing. Were this not so, then the metaphor would be love is love, and who could learn anything from that one? We should be familiar with the structurality I am suggesting. We have seen it before in our consideration of play, seduction, flesh, and we have been building richer understandings of the profundity of this structurality in our discussions of depth, chiasm, proprioception, dark space, and movement. Perhaps a more interesting way of thinking about the relation of the two parts of the metaphor is in Merleau-Ponty's terms of the visible and the invisible, rather than the concrete and the abstract. Reviewing Kevitch's list of common categories for source and target domains in metaphor, there is a general correlation with the visible and invisible. Body, health and illness, animals, plants, buildings and constructions, machines and tools, games and sports, money and economic terms, and so forth, are the categories common to the source domain, while emotion, desire, morality, thought, society, nation, politics, economy, human relationships, communication, time, religion, and so on are categories common to the target domain. I think there needs to be more extensive consideration than I have time to do here, but my guess is that even those target domains that are not invisible, such as human relationships, as I have shown above, have a hidden invisible, such as feelings or emotions. The common argument is that body and bodily experience is involved in the source domain. This body involvement is the basis for the source domain to be understood as concrete. However, when we consider the target domain, while it is invisible, can it be any less bodily involved? Experience itself suggests the persisting internal bodily connection with the history of the body. Experience is not simply the mechanical and physical movement of the body. It is the impression such posture and movement has and has over time. Experience is a store of the effects and affects of mechanical and physical movement. More than a store, it is a deepening well of evolving and changing implications that are essential to affordance and perception. Surely it is a limited or naive understanding of body, perhaps overly shaped by vision, which sees only the body visible, that truncates this standard argument. Emotion, feeling, proprioception, visceral perception are all deeply bodied and, frankly, anything but abstract. What is abstract about felt pain or the felt knowledge that we sometimes term belief? What we know in our bodily feelings are the hidden certainties that drive everything that we do. If we accept, then, that metaphor structurality is comprised of the visible and the invisible, or in bodily terms, the external and the internal, we must then recognize that metaphor structurality is necessarily grounded on depth, the identity of inside and outside, of visible and invisible, has co-present implications, a thickness, a depth. Metaphor structurality can be restated as an inside thing is an outside thing. Metaphor, then, is reversible in turning one outside in. Metaphor is the complement to and in continuity with perception, which is grounded in the flesh of the world. Metaphor as perception is trafficked in the depth between the inside and outside, the invisible and the visible, concept and form, idea and action. Metaphor as a trope is of a different order than perception. Metaphor is a language act and a conceptual act, yet, like perception, it still functions, in naive terms, to bring the outside in, or, in more sophisticated terms, to engage the interdependence of outside and inside in the human enterprise of being in the world. And like perception, metaphor is thoroughly embodied. Metaphor is not unidirectional so much as it is an incomplete reversibility. The incompleteness of the reversibility of the metaphor is the not to the is, and the not typically remains hidden. The metaphor is stated, love is a journey, emphasizing the is. However, of actually greater importance is the hidden certainty that love is not a journey. The reversibility implied by the is known to be incomplete, but only by the hidden and unstated not. In Merleau-Ponty's terms, this hidden not, this incompleteness in the reversibility, is the chiasm, the crossing place between the two terms of the metaphor, the crossing place where comparison, negotiation, revelation, expansion, construction, creation, thought, and action occur. Metaphor then succeeds perception in a logical sense and depends on it. Yet metaphor is in continuity with flesh. The thickness or depth of metaphor is dependent on an awareness of a primordial, pure depth, which I discussed in some detail in the last lecture. This is but a prolegomenon towards a shift in the way we understand metaphor. I think it complements and extends the understanding of metaphor presented by Kevitches and also by Lakoff and Johnson. Clearly, a fuller exploration of the metaphor structurality in light of play, seduction, flesh, and so forth will be important, as will considering the implications of this perspective on the many metaphor-related topics. So there should be a part two to this lecture, followed by perhaps a dozen or so more. Now I want to turn to the topic of gesture. This is a complex topic, yet I am interested in thinking about it, I suppose, in more of a reactive than a directly constructive way. I'll focus on Sean Gallagher's chapter, The Body in Gesture, in his book, How the Body Shapes the Mind, knowing full well that there is a large literature on gesture that I have not yet carefully read. First, I must say that I'm tired of Gallagher's use of Ian Waterman. This poor guy's loss of proprioception is Gallagher's career gain, it seems to me. I understand that the single exceptional case is often the ground for breakthrough knowledge, yet I am often not very persuaded by the Waterman case. I also have loads of questions about Gallagher's claim that Waterman has no proprioceptive feedback from the neck down. While I do not doubt that Waterman has no awareness of proprioceptive feedback, I think that, even under visual control, something as muscularly complicated as walking is not possible without proprioceptive feedback to the brain of some sort. I need to do more research on how muscles work in conjunction with proprioceptors of various kinds, but what I have discovered so far is that basically every muscle movement is necessarily meshed with proprioception. Gallagher is considering gesture in terms of two explanations of gesture. The motor theory holds that gesture is a matter of movement, falling within the domain of sensory motor behavior. The other, a communications-based theory, holds that gesture is a form of expressive action, a communicative act tied to linguistic and communicative processes. Gallagher argues for the communication theory and further distinguishes two aspects of gesture, its intersubjective, that is communicative, and intrasubjective, that is cognitive functions. In other words, gestures are good to talk and good to think. As I think about this, it seems clear to me that the rather routinized patterns of gesturing that accompanies common discourse points strongly to the motor theory. There simply isn't enough variation, as there clearly is in American Sign Language, for example, to achieve anything like the level of speech communication. On the other hand, clearly there is an expressive aspect to gesture that is undeniable. The discussion of gesture is all too commonly limited to hands. Elocution was a form of rhetoric popular in the 18th century that recognized the importance to the art of oratory of gesture, stance, and dress. Elocution prescribed specific hand gestures to accomplish specific effects. But even in elocution, while prescribed, gesture was not a matter of simply the isolated hand. It was a movement of the arm and hand connected with the posture and the stance of the body. In Gallagher's discussion of gesture, as in a few other studies I have read, gesture is almost constantly referred to as limited to the hand or hands. For example, Gallagher writes, "One requirement for gesture is that there be some knowledge in the system concerning the location of the hands relative to each other and relative to the rest of the body." He even consults Ramachandran's studies of amputees to see if phantom limbs have evidence of gesture or phantom gesture. He understands the flapping of stumped upper arms as evidence of gesture were the hands to be there, rather than the moving stumps themselves being gestures. My point is this. While Gallagher argues for an embodied theory of gesture, he appears not to understand the fundamentals of movement. Hands are the extremities connected to the trunk of the body by arms. Movement of the hands, particularly any hand movement that we would call gesture, also involves the arms. Movement of the arms and hands is initiated from the core of the body and is inseparable from the posture and placement of the entire body. When the analysis of gesture is limited to attending only to hands and the intricacies of digital movement, focus on articulation and communication is predictable. However, if gesture is understood as being initiated in the core of the body and in sequence extended into the arms and finally the hands, a different understanding should arise. The arm and hand movements are then the articulation of the body's core, which is strongly associated with feelings, emotions, depth, rather than cognition, articulate communication, speech, and thought. Rather than being cognitive linguistic, gesture may be emotive and affective. Based on his experiments with Waterman, Gallagher holds that gesture is not under the control of either body image or body schema, nor is gesture under either visual or proprioceptive control. He holds that gesture is essentially language and functions primarily to communicative contexts. Again, I think that the shortcoming here is the same as that for metaphor in the discussion above. Gallagher has a body concept that separates hands from bodies, that separates emotion and feeling from cognition and language. Were we to recouple hands to arms to bodies and feelings and emotions to cognition and language, gesture would be complementary to language in communicating the emotional counterpart to the simple conduit understanding of language expression and the embodied metaphorical understanding of conception and cognition. When concepts are thoroughly entwined with body via metaphor, when metaphor has by its structurality depth that is inseparable from emotion and feeling, then speech needs multiple channels by which to express and affect its full richness and nuance. Gesture is not the only means of doing this. So too are facial expressions and the nuances of speech articulation, that is, the vocal qualities, timing, and emphasis of speech. There is a well-developed speech act theory initiated by J.L. Austin's book, How to Do Things with Words, that explores the amazing complexities of articulation. The pragmatic and locutionary aspects of speech are well considered. So gesture may clearly have a communication function. However, I think it impossible to understand it as Gallagher contends that gesture is essentially language. On another point, Gallagher argues that gestures are products, as well as active producers, of brain organization. Reviewing his neonate imitation data, he proposes that gesture helps to accomplish thought. This idea is more fully developed by Raymond Gibbs in his consideration of gesture and language. Gibbs writes, Iverson and Thalen, in a 1999 study, claimed that speech and gesture momentarily activate and entrain one another as a coupled oscillator. At first, an infant's manual activity takes precedence, but through rhythmical activity and later through gesture, manual behavior gradually entrains the speech production system. The initial basis to move hand and mouth together cascade with a single coupled connected system where the mental thought is manifested as movement. Eventually, every communicative act, either by speech or gesture, is remembered as an ensemble, including the proprioceptive consequence of that movement. This linkage of speech and gesture provides another example of the sensory motor origins of thought and of the continual importance of embodied action in mental life. So we might say, based on this quotation from Gibbs, that speech and gesture are good to think. Gibbs' chapter, Language and Communication, offers insights and extensive evidence on how language and communication are based in body. For example, he concludes that human bodies provide the conceptual basis for defining the range of meanings associated with each verb for hand motion in any language. Importantly, he shows that people create meaningful construals by stimulating how the objects and actions depicted in language relate to embodied possibilities. Thus, people use their embodied experiences to soft assemble meaning rather than merely activate pre-existing abstract conceptual representations. There are many things of merit in Gibbs' chapter, but I'll take time here to respond to but one of them. In a number of the experiments reported by Gibbs, the response time of subjects was often considered a measure of meaning. The more immediate the comprehension, the greater the meaning. For example, near the end of the chapter, Gibbs discusses affordance. In terms of the affordance related to the word chair, he provides two sentences. Art used the chair to defend himself against the snarling lion, and Art used the chair to propel himself across the room. He noted that people judged the first sentence more meaningful, which he argues is associated with a greater affordance of using a chair to defend against a lion than to propel oneself across the floor. Interestingly, my experience, which I think representative of most, would actually produce the opposite. I have often sat in a desk chair with rollers and propelled myself around the room, but I have yet to face a lion or any other animal with a chair. Who on earth would carry a chair along for such purposes? However, the issue I want to address has to do with the correlation of speed of comprehension with meaning. Gibbs writes that the non-afforded sentences took significantly longer to comprehend than the afforded ones. It seems to me that there is a general understanding that speed of comprehension correlates with meaningfulness. Something incomprehensible, such as John scratched his back with thread, is deemed incomprehensible and thus without meaning because it registers long response times. I am not so sure Gibbs would actually believe that comprehension speed always correlates with meaning, but it is a point I want to consider further. Jonathan Smith, citing Paul Ricoeur, argues that incongruity gives rise to thought. So too does poetry, complexity, profundity, incredulity, seductivity, and many of the topics we have discussed. Comprehension speed may indicate superficial or customary comprehensiveness, but it does not correlate with meaning. I often make a distinction between the words meaning and meaningful. The meaningful is full of meaning, suggesting there is much to comprehend, that there is much to think about, that thinking actually creates more and more meaning. I can, in a microsecond, dismiss as quotidian the statement, "John scratched his back with a floppy disk," finding little about it remarkable beyond the increasing rarity of floppy disks. It is mere information, useful or not, but certainly not provocative or interesting. Not so with the statement, "John scratched his back with thread." This is of interest, and it is so for the very structurality that shares with metaphor. It contains a hidden depth, and it does so precisely because that depth is a gap, an incredulity, an incomprehensibility, a chiasm, and these provocations rise precisely because the statement confounds affordance programs. What sort of thing is John that he could scratch his back with thread? What sort of thread might work for such a task? Why does he scratch with thread rather than a thread? Perhaps this is symbolic in some sense and needs to be placed in context. Who would make such a statement? I think it is unfortunate that our culture and era confuses meaning with information and with rapid comprehension speed. It consigns us to a fast-paced, information-crowded world with little depth or likeness. I could go on to preach a bit about the ill consequences of living in a world where production supplants seduction, where hyperreality is our reality, where our energies are directed to end play, to deny depth, and to celebrate being simple. I'll pass on that one and end with an exercise of my duty to you as students of religion and culture. So how do these topics and insights, be there any you find significant, relate to or might be of value to the study of religion and culture? Metaphor is foundational, I believe, to any comparative study, to any study of any other. Metaphor is foundational to who we are as human beings, how we build conceptions, how we understand ourselves, how we create ourselves. Metaphor, as I argue above, is fundamental to being human. As many studies of metaphor show, because many structural and ontological metaphors are based on the distinctiveness of the human body, metaphor offers a base, a ground, for comparison, and also translation. Were there not some ground common to all human beings, then we would have no place to stand to consider the more interesting differences. A careful study of these body-based metaphors shared among human beings is then important for this fundamental stance. However, metaphor is also powerfully shaped by culture, by history, by any articulation of experience. Since all experience is body-based, and since all bodies are also cultural and historical, then to explore the operative metaphors of other peoples is a powerful method, providing a way to hopefully surpass our studies being simply projections of our expectations onto others. Much more could be said on this. I also believe that to understand metaphor structurality, as I have begun to develop it, is important for our self-understanding and appreciation. To embrace the hidden chiasm of metaphor is to open ourselves to profundity and richness, to depth and beauty. To understand gesture, especially in terms of the perspective of gesture being connected with emotion and feeling and with the communication of affect, is to significantly broaden our understanding of embodiment, of communication, of cognition, of being human. We need to embrace the whole body perspective that acknowledges that emotion and feeling are the often hidden motors that drive communication, action, thought, and behavior. As emotion is inseparable from body and body is inseparable from thought and communication, we must embrace it in our studies. To do so, especially for studies of religion and culture, would effect a striking shift from our present practices. Thank you for listening to this volume of Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series by the same title. I am making this lecture series in print form available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. Thank you very much for listening to this volume, and I'll be talking to you again later. Bye-bye.